Today's lecture will seek to outline how the textual representations of space were affected by two major shifts in the literature of the period between the turn of the 20th century and the late 1960s, which is roughly the time span of our module. Arguably, these two literary shifts coincided with two major transitions in the social ethos and ideology of the period. Firstly, the dominant worldview changed from a deep-seated faith in the collective to the worship of the strong, exceptional individual. And then, most markedly after the Second World War, faith in the individual gave way to a renewed preoccupation with the collective. Such radical transitions in what we may loosely call the philosophy of the period we study affected both the contents and the form of the works written at the time. As regards contents, the changing social focus from the collective to the individual was reflected directly by the thematic motifs of the contemporary literature. Modernist fiction, for example, abounds in strong independent characters, both male and female, who refuse to conform to what they perceive as oppressive social norms and values. You remember Stephen Dedalus wanted to discover the mode of life or of art whereby his spirit could express itself in unfettered freedom. Similarly, Lily Briscoe refuses to comply with the social imperative to marry and instead finds personal fulfillment in a private artistic experience. At the end of the novel, she is aware that her painting, which is the culmination of her artistic endeavour, might end up hung in an attic, hidden from public view, even destroyed. But this prospect does not seem important to her or the narrative as a whole. What matters is that she has had her vision. She has had this meaningful experience. Whether she can share it with the public, with society at large, is simply immaterial. These even individualistic preoccupations began to lose momentum in the 1930s and began to appear rather irrelevant in the wake of the Second World War, when collective values, the collective experience, gained prominence once again. Post-World War II literature dwells on the shared experience of destruction and loss, valorizing the social and personal connections which the conflict has severed. You remember Waiting for Godot reveals an alien post-apocalyptic world whose social fabric is torn apart, a world in which normal human relationships are confined to a distant past and appear only as fleeting memories to the protagonists. Likewise, the literature of the 1950s and 60s in Britain, epitomized by the works of the angry young men, authors such as John Osborne, John Brain and Alan Sillitoe, is preoccupied with the idea of belonging, of class, of social integration and social mobility. This essentially collectivist agenda is best exemplified by the title of John Brain's novel, Room at the Top. As we said earlier, these shifts in emphasis, first onto the individual and then back onto the collective, determined also the formal features of the literary works written at the time, which in turn affected the way space was imagined, recreated, and produced. In today's lecture, I will attempt to outline how the textual representations of space changed as a result of the formalist experiment of literary modernism and the subsequent return to realism later in the 20th century. The experimental style of modernism as a formal expression of individualist concerns was certainly gaining momentum before the First World War. But in the wake of the conflict, especially in the 1920s, it was almost elevated to the status of a literary orthodoxy. It was at this time that a clash of critical opinion emerged between two prominent figures of the British literary scene, or rather a prominent one, established writer Arnold Bennett, and another, still aspiring to become prominent, Virginia Woolf. At the time, Woolf had left a mark on the literary landscape with the publication of her novel Jacob's Room, but was yet to write the masterpieces she is now remembered for, namely Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse. In an article with the rather ominous title, Is the Novel Decaying?, published in March 1923, Bennett had the following to say about Woolf. And this is the first quotation on your handout. I have seldom read a cleverer book than Virginia Woolf's Jacob's Room, a novel which has made a great stir in a small world. It is packed and bristling with originality, and it is exquisitely written. But the characters do not vitally survive in the mind because the author has been obsessed by details of originality and cleverness. I regard this book as characteristic of the new novelists who have recently gained attention of the alert and the curious, and I admit that for myself, I cannot yet descry any coming big novelists. I think that we have today a number of young novelists who display all manner of good qualities, originality of view, ingenuity of presentment, sound common sense, and even style. But they appear to be interested more in details than in the full creation of their individual characters. Right. Unsurprisingly, Woolf took umbrage at this rather unflattering description of being too clever for her own good and gave Bennett a piece of her mind in what was to become one of her most famous essays, Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, which appeared the same year as Arnold's article, that is, 1923. In the essay, Woolf sought to problematize the central premise of Bennett's critique, the fact that the novelists of the time could not create convincing, full-blooded individual characters. She agrees with Bennett that the novel has lost its character-making power and has become populated with soulless bodies cumbering our tables and clogging our minds. However, she puts the blame for this deplorable state of affairs with the older generation of writers, the Edwardians, as she calls them, to whom Bennett himself belongs, alongside Herbert Wells and John Galsworthy. When we examine Edwardian fiction, one strange fact is immediately apparent, she claims. This is the second quotation on the first page of your handout. Every sort of town is represented, and innumerable institutions. We see factories, prisons, workhouses, law courts, houses of parliament, a general clamour, the voice of aspiration, effort and industry rises from the whole. But in all this vast conglomeration of printed pages, in all this congeries of streets and houses, there is not a single man or woman whom we know. Woolf maintains that in their overzealous strive to recreate objective reality as it is, quote-unquote, down to the most minute of detail, the Edwardians have failed to capture the subjective reality of the individual, of the human being. In order to illustrate her point better, Woolf invents a non-existent literary character, Mrs. Brown, and proceeds to analyse her portrayal in keeping with the realist convention espoused by the Edwardians. Now, there's a rather long quotation, which is number three on the handout. I'm not going to go over it in detail. You can read it at home. I'm just going to sum it up. According to Woolf, the Edwardian realists got it all wrong because they had approached the portrayal of human beings in much the same manner as they had approached the depiction of physical objects. Consequently, to Woolf, the Mrs. Brown we're likely to come across in Edwardian fiction is entirely devoid of life. She has become at one with the physical surroundings she inhabits, yet another piece of furniture in her meticulously described house, which can be reduced to splinters and in fact must be reduced to splinters for a true lifelike character to emerge in the novel. Now, in both Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, as well as in another famous essay, Modern Fiction, Woolfe appears as a pretty shrewd judge of realist aesthetics, highlighting and interrogating some of its central premises. Realism in general, which includes literary realism, operates under the fundamental assumption that it presents reality directly and without distortion. It is often defined by its proponents as a lack of style and a rejection of conventions. Realists in the 19th century compared themselves to scientists and imitated the traditional scientific methods of inquiry, that is, observation and description in their work. For they believed it was only through a painstakingly accurate observation and description of the physical world that a truthful representation of reality can be achieved. In keeping with this belief, realist writers strove to emulate the reader's empirical knowledge of his circumambient universe. Therefore, the realist representation of space is a three-dimensional continuum holding a plethora of other perfectly random objects. So that's the type of space that we find in realist texts, a three-dimensional continuum populated with random objects. It is precisely this predilection for enumerating things in a three-dimensional space that Woolfe criticizes in her essay Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, because, in her opinion, it leads to an objectification of the human self. To emphasize this danger further, Woolfe describes the three foremost proponents of realist literature at the time, namely Wells, Galsworthy, and Bennet, of course, as materialists, as they are obsessed with matter, not life. The underlying assumption here is quite insulting to the Edwardians, of course, who prided themselves on being able to capture life as it is, quote-unquote. But the true target of Woolfe's attack is realism itself, which Woolfe finds lacking in verisimilitude. It is quite significant that the dismantling of the realist convention that Woolfe advocates in Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown is metaphorically represented by the dismantling of the house Mrs. Brown lives in, which, after all, is a spatial construct that seems to stifle the character who inhabits it. When you go back to the quotation, you'll be able to see what she says about the house, the fact that the mansion in which Mrs. Brown lives is actually something that traps her and does not allow her to become real, to gain flesh and blood in the mind of the reader. So essentially, the problem with character portrayal that Woolfe identifies in Bennet and realism in general is the representation, in many ways, of space in the realist novel. In other words, we'll be justified in saying that the move away from realism, a move in search of a more authentic recreation of life in literature, would entail a reworking, a reimagining of the three-dimensional representation of space. But how is the author to achieve this? Woolfe's answer, as best illustrated in her essay Modern Fiction, is by looking within the mind of the character. And now there's this fourth quotation on the first page of your handout. "Look within, and life, it seems, is very far from being like this. Examine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel, From all sides they come, an incessant shower of innumerable atoms, and as they fall, as they shape themselves into the life of Monday or Tuesday, the accent falls differently from of old. The moment of importance came not here, but there, so that if a writer were a free man and not a slave, if he could write what he chose, not what he must, if he could base his work upon his own feeling and not upon convention, there would be no plot, no comedy, no tragedy, no love interest or catastrophe in the accepted style, and perhaps not a single button sewn on as the Bond Street tailors would have it. Life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged. Life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. Is it not the task of the novelist to convey this varying, this unknown and uncircumscribed spirit, whatever aberration or complexity it may display, with as little mixture of the alien and external as possible? We are not pleading merely for courage and sincerity. We are suggesting that the proper stuff of fiction is a little other than custom would have us believe it. This is actually quite funny, because what Wolfe is suggesting is she's trying to beat the realists on their own game, in a way. Realists were claiming that their representation of life is actually authentic. But she says, hang on a minute, is this really life? Do we experience life the way we find life in realist novels or the novels of the Edwardians? No, it isn't. Life is something very different. So she's trying to turn the argument of authenticity against the realists who were using it in the first place, right? Now, the first important thing that Wolfe does in this particular essay here is that she identifies realism, which she associates here with the Edwardians, as a convention and not only natural and not the only natural or authentic way of representing the world, which is what 19th century realists and their 20th century counterparts would argue. Secondly, she uses spatial metaphors to describe the representation of life in both realist and modernist fiction. Wolfe suggests that the realist convention recreates reality as a strictly regimented external space, a series of gig lamps that are symmetrically arranged. It is precisely this element of order and implied restriction that renders life in the realist novel inauthentic, according to Wolfe. Conversely, the type of fiction that she favours describes reality as undifferentiated, dynamic, and mostly internal. It does not exist independently of the individual consciousness, but is coincidental with it. The objective space of the 19th century realist novel has become, in Wolfe's understanding of reality and life, a subjective category, subjective space, which is filtered through the perceptions of the protagonists. Now, in order to see what exactly this sort of internal space looks like, as opposed to the external space of the realist novel, I suggest you have a look at the excerpt that I've photocopied for you on the handout on page 2. This is from James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And if you remember, this is the so-called overture. This is what Hugh Kenner calls this part of the novel, the overture to the novel, which sums up in a nutshell the sort of the main themes that would be further developed in the narrative. So we'll just have a look at the sort of the first half a page. That's page 7. Now, once upon a time, and a very good time it was, there was a moo cow coming down along the road, and this moo cow was coming down along the road, met a nicest little boy named Baby Taku. His father told him that story. His father looked at him through a glass. He had a hairy face. He was Baby Taku. The moo cow came down the road where Betty Byrne lived. She sold lemon plat. Oh, the wild rose blossoms on the little green place. He sang that song. That was his song. Oh, the green wath bothered. Right. So even within this short passage that I've just read out, we can come across no less than three different localities. Okay, this is what the internal space looks like in the modernist novel. Firstly, there is the place where the story which Simon Dedalus tells is set. Okay, the moo cow came down the road where Betty Byrne lived. So this is place number one. There is also the place occupied by Stephen and his father, of whom Stephen is very conscious. You see the beard, the monocle, presumably, that the father's wearing. And finally, the third place is the little green place of Stephen's song where the wild rose blossoms. Since we're told this is Stephen's song, it is natural to assume that the green place mentioned in it is distinct from the place in Simon Dedalus' story where Betty Byrne lives. These three locations are put together haphazardly, following the principle of free association that governs Stephen's thoughts. A principle whereby one thought leads to another by simple analogy. In this particular passage, we can see how Stephen's consciousness moves from the story of Baby Taku to the face of his father, who's telling the story, and finally to another story narrated in the song. So to recapitulate, the type of spatial representation that we find here is different from the representation of the realist novel, because it does not seem to contain the individual in a three-dimensional continuum, which was the case with realism. Rather, the individual seems to contain the world. The shift from the world within to the world without that we've just seen, from the physical space of realist writing to the subjective experience of space in modernist writing, has had serious ramifications for the way space is recreated in the narrative. If realism treats space as a concrete and stable phenomenon, a three-dimensional continuum which is quite separate from the temporal aspect of being, the modernist technique of focalized narration begins to disrupt its stability and universality. What is more, space begins to be seen as inextricably linked with time, rather than being an independent, autonomous phenomenon. By establishing a link between space and time, which is evident even in Woolf's modern fiction, if you remember, she talks about life there as not a series of gig lamps, but a luminous halo that falls into Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So the link between space and time, through establishing this link between space and time, modernist writers sought to redress the disrupted balance between these two categories in their contemporary world, a problem which seems to have dominated much of late 19th and early 20th century European thought, and most prominently the work of French philosopher Henri Bergson, Bergson, it's Bergson, and Henri is like Henry with an I at the end. Similarly to Woolf and other modernist writers, although considerably earlier than them, Bergson rejects the idea that time and life are a series of separate events or divisible phenomena. Such views he considers to be essentially misleading, as they are based on habits of thought appropriate only for conceptualizing space. In his book Time and Free Will, published in 1889, he maintains that time, conceived as a homogeneous medium, is some spurious concept, due to the trespassing of the idea of space upon the field of pure consciousness. For Bergson, this misconception leads to the error of supposing that time is a quantity, one that can be divided up and parceled out like a piece of material. A principal agent in making such divisions is, of course, the clock, which dissects time into lumps and units. As such, it is the natural focus of Bergson's criticism, as it presents an obstacle to the true mental experience of time, which he calls duration. Now, this is a short excerpt from Time and Free Will, which you haven't got on your handout. When I follow with my eyes on the dial of a clock, the movement of the hands, I do not measure duration. Outside of me, in space, there is never more than a single position of the hand. Within myself, a process of organization or interpenetration of conscious states is going on, which constitutes true duration. So the true duration is interpenetration of conscious states. States of consciousness, even when successive, permeate one another, and in the simplest of them, the whole soul can be reflected. Bergson's belief that real time exists only in the human mind as a continuous flow of interpenetrating states of consciousness was amongst the main influences behind the radical transformation of the spatio-temporal framework of early 20th century fiction. We have already noted that the focalized narration of the modernist novel dismantled the stability of concrete physical space, which realism had taken for granted. However, the subjective psychological space that came out as a result of this narrative strategy was different not only in scope, but also in nature to the three-dimensional space of realism. It became inseparable from, if not subsidiary to, the temporality of human experience. Once filtered through the individual perception of a novelistic character, the objective world became subordinate to what psychologist William James described as the stream of consciousness, that is, the continuously flowing connectedness of our experience. The internalized perspective of the modernist writing has thus joined space and time into a four-dimensional frame, for which Einstein's term space-time can be seen as an appropriate shorthand. Einstein enjoyed enormous popularity in the 1920s, after his ideas had been apparently confirmed by observations carried out during the solar eclipse of May 1919. Difficult as his ideas were to grasp, there soon appeared a huge literature of explanation and introduction. Bertrand Russell's, for example, there's a text by Bertrand Russell's, The ABC of Relativity, which came out in 1926. Works like these ensured that, as Wyndham Lewis put it, within a few years of the arrival of Einstein upon the European scene, the layman, I suppose, knows more about relativity physics than any layman has ever known about the Newtonian cosmology. That was a quotation from Tyne and Western Man, which is a major work of cultural criticism by Wyndham Lewis that came out in 1927. Wyndham Lewis, perhaps you know, a famous novelist and intellectual of the time, felt passionately against what he called the school of Bergson-Einstein, of which he thought James Joyce to be a prominent disciple. And there's another quotation from Time and Western Man. The philosophy of space-timists is identical with the old Bergsonian philosophy of psychological time, or durée, as he called it. It is essential to grasp this continuity between the earlier flux of Bergson with its time god and the Einsteinian flux with its god space-time. In one way, this assumption of uniform thinking among all these contemporary thinkers is simply wrong. Bergson's insistence that ideas of space must be kept separate from concepts of time differs quite clearly from the views of Einstein's idea of space-time. Such differences between Bergson and the space-timists of the 1920s were clearly pointed out by Bertrand Russell and ought to have been clear enough in philosophical circles in any case. However, Lewis was right to conclude that the stream of consciousness technique, which his contemporaries had privileged, led to an ultimate dissolution of the spatial and temporal boundaries in the literary representations of the world. The emergence of space-time of modernist writing was unlike anything that the 19th century realism had created. There is a useful analogy that you may apply to remember the distinction between the spatial representations of realism and modernism. Realist space is analogous, or can be seen as analogous, to the three-dimensional space of Newtonian physics, while modernist space is more akin to the four-dimensional time-space conceptualized by Einstein. In order to illustrate how this four-dimensional space-time functions in the modernist novel, we can have a look at an excerpt from Virginia Woolf's novel Mrs. Dalloway, which is on your handout. There's this excerpt that I've basically surrounded with black lines, and I'll quickly go through it. She had had the oddest sense of being herself invisible, unseen, unknown. There being no more marrying, no more having of children now, but only this astonishing and rather solemn progress with the rest of them up Bond Street. This being Mrs. Dalloway, not even Clarissa anymore. This being Mrs. Richard Dalloway. By the way, in this excerpt, we see Clarissa Dalloway walking through central London on her way to the florist's as she needs to buy flowers for the party she's hosting later that day. So this is the background. Bond Street fascinated her. Bond Street, early in the morning, in the season, its flags flying, its shops, no splash, no glitter, one roll of tweed in the shop where her father had bought his suits for 50 years, a few pearls, salmon on an ice block. That is all, she said, looking at the fishmongers. That is all, she repeated, pausing for a moment at the window of a glove shop where, before the war, you could buy almost perfect gloves. And her old uncle William used to say, a lady is known by her shoes and her gloves. He had turned on his bed one morning in the middle of the war. He had said, I've had enough. Gloves and shoes, she had a passion for gloves, but her own daughter, her Elizabeth, cared not a straw for either of them. Not a straw, she thought, going on up Bond Street to a shop where they kept flowers for her when she gave a party. Elizabeth really cared for her dog most of all. Now, the place where the scene is set is quite clear. It's Bond Street. However, the way the place is perceived by the protagonist and relayed to the reader through the device of focalized narration is rather different from what you would normally find in a realist text. The locality is not simply fixed within the there and then of Clarissa's walk to the florist's, but rather stretched alongside a time axis, which includes that moment, but also a number of other temporal occurrences in the past. Bond Street, early in the morning, in the season, which is a kind of representative image of the place in early summer, as the story takes place in June. Then you have Bond Street, where Clarissa's father has been buying his suits for 50 years. Then the pre-war Bond Street, where Clarissa was buying almost perfect gloves, quote unquote. So when the locality, the place, is transposed from the outside world of realism to the intra-subjective world of modernism, what appears to be a single uniform space, Bond Street, as we would normally conceive it to be, is multiplied, becomes plural. The subjective space is never a three-dimensional container, but a point of convergence of the individual's experience of that place. Now, you remember I mentioned earlier in today's lecture that the decades after the Second World War saw a return to a collective communal values that modernism had rejected. We're going to go back to this. The LMW text, which best exemplifies this return to collective values, to community concerns, is Ngugi wa Thiong'o's A Grain of Wheat. I will briefly discuss this at the end of the lecture again, but before that, because A Grain of Wheat belongs to the colonial / post-colonial thematic trajectory of the module, I shall first make a short chronological detour and explore how space is recreated in colonial literature. To begin with, it is important to note that the very term colony has in fact a spatial meaning. It is derived from the Latin noun colonus, which means husbandman or farmer, which is in turn related to the verb colere, to till. In other words, colony is fundamentally a spatial concept, which is originally related to the cultivation of the land. This notion of cultivation is at the heart of the typical colonial myth of the virginal land, awaiting the experienced, caring hand of the white settler in the settler colonies. It also underlines the urge to discover new territories, which is essentially an act of putting a stamp on the land, an act of epistemological and or actual acquisition. The text on our reading list that deals most explicitly with the problems of Western colonialism is, of course, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. In many ways, Conrad's novella reveals more about metropolitan Western attitudes towards Africa rather than the territory of the Belgian Congo itself. For critics such as Chinua Achebe, you'll remember, this makes the text complicit with colonial ideology, as it shares its underlying ethos of appropriation and ownership. The main focus of Achebe's critique is not so much the favorable or unfavorable representation of the African people in Heart of Darkness, but that Africa and its people are available for discursive appropriation by the European writer. In other words, the problem with Conrad's account lies in the ethical assumptions implicit in his representations of indigenous Africa, of the space of Africa. The fact that by reducing a whole continent to a symbol of primitive and atavistic humanity, Conrad has effectively devalued and dehumanized its multiple and complex pre-colonial societies. At stake for Achebe is not merely a lack of knowledge, but a willful resistance on the part of Europeans to learn about Africa, which is a manifestation of a deep-seated psychological need to set up Africa as an empty space, a place of negation, he calls it, against which Europe's own state of spiritual grace can be set out. And this is a need which can be traced back historically to the earliest encounters between Europeans and Africans. Thus, it will not be an overstatement to say that within the epistemological economy of colonialism, Africa becomes a non-place, simply a function of the European imagination. That is, a place which is governed by essentially a Eurocentric projection. Okay, let's have a quick look at the excerpts from Conrad. By the way, I skipped this poem by T.S. Eliot, which shows a very beautiful juxtaposition between time on the clock and time as experienced by the individual, that is the Bergsonian durée or duration, and you might want to think about it at home or maybe even discuss it in the seminar if there is time for this. Now, to go back to Conrad, the first excerpt, which is from page 142 of my edition of Conrad, I'll just go over a couple of paragraphs here. Now, this describes Marlowe's first memories. Marlowe is reminiscing about how he found out about Africa and what Africa stood for him when he was a child. Okay. It's quite significant for the European mindset about the colonies and the rest of the world. Now, when I was a little chap, I had a passion for maps. I would look for hours at South America or Africa or Australia and lose myself in all the glories of exploration. At that time, there were many blank spaces on the earth, and when I saw one that looked particularly inviting on a map, but they all looked that, I would put my finger on it and say, when I grow up, I will go there. Then further down the page. But there was one yet the biggest, the most blank, so to speak, that I had a hankering after. True. By this time, it was not a blank space anymore. It had got filled since my boyhood with rivers and lakes and names. This is Alder Marlowe speaking. It had ceased to be a blank space of delightful mystery, a white patch for a boy to dream gloriously over. It had become a place of darkness. But there was in it one river, especially a mighty big river, that you could see on the map, resembling an immense snake uncoiled, with its head in the sea, its body at rest, curving afar over a vast country, and its tail lost in the depths of the land. And as I looked at the map of it in a shop window, it fascinated me as a snake would a bird, a silly little bird. Right. This is a perfect illustration of the colonial myth of the virginal land, of the land which is not inscribed, but is just blank, lying there, waiting for the European to go and discover it. Of course, Africa, as well as all the other colonies, were discovered because they were populated by indigenous people. However, simply because the dominant worldview that we find here and globally was one of Europe, then the discovery simply didn't take place. But there's something also very interesting about the way the older Marlowe imagines Africa. The central stage in this imagined Africa is given to the image of a snake, which is a kind of atavistic image. An image that is exotic, fantastic, not quite linked to something palpable and objective. Essentially, the older Marlowe is projecting a fantasy, an exotic fantasy about the place, onto the place, and perceives this to be kind of the reality of the place. So in this colonial mindset, fiction and fact seem to sort of merge, and it's very easy to cross over from the world of fantasy into the world of reality. Now, we haven't got time to go over the entirety of the second passage that I've selected from Conrad, but I'll just read out three sentences, which I find very significant. This is already Marlowe telling the story of the journey up the Congo. We were wanderers on a prehistoric earth, on an earth that wore the aspect of an unknown planet. Then further on he says, the prehistoric man was cursing us, praying to us, welcoming us. Who could tell? We could not understand because we were too far and could not remember, because we were traveling in the night of first ages, of those ages that are gone, leaving hardly a sign and no memories. So the way Africa is represented here is essentially the past of Western civilization, the past of Western man. The implicit assumption is that since African culture is not materially advanced, then it must be primitive. It's an assumption, of course, that has justified the civilizing mission of the West, which the colonial enterprise was arguably carrying out. You know, this was the justification of going and actually stealing the resources of the different places around the world and exploiting their population, that essentially Europeans were civilizing them. Now, there is also an interesting crossover between the sort of the atavistic image of the snake and the atavistic representation of African humanity and Africa as a place. In both these excerpts, we are dealing with assumptions about the other, myths and fantasies which are superimposed onto a different non-European culture. But this habit of thought of superimposing fantasies onto a place that is not yours, that is culturally different, is not confined to Marlowe. In fact, it tells us a lot more about human psychology in general. With this in mind, I'll just ask you to have a look at Elizabeth Bishop's poems. I'll quickly go over them. The first, I'm sure that you've come across these poems before, so there's no need to just read out the text. The first poem, Arrival at Santouche, recreates the moment of another intercultural encounter, the moment of disembarkment of US tourists at the Brazilian port of Santouche. Seen through the eyes of the tourists, their arrival is a moment of cultural shock, which betrays some underlying assumptions which, although very different from Marlowe's assumptions about the Africans as natives, are driven by the same economy of projection and cultural blindness vis-a-vis an unknown human reality. The surprise at the sight of the Brazilian flag, the thought of a different currency and language which gradually dawn onto the poetic persona, reveal a rather naive, if not ignorant, attitude towards foreign places. But they also reveal that the automatic assumption of the visitors is one of sameness, of identity with the other, which is why the difference they find comes as a surprise. Here, however, unlike in Conrad, the poetic persona seems aware of their own cultural limitations, of their own blind spot with regard to this culturally different place, as is evident by the irony with which the first person, the irony with which the first impressions of Brazil are conveyed. "O tourist, is that how this country is going to answer you and your immodest demands for a different world and a better life and complete comprehension of both at last and immediately after 18 days of suspension?" The self-mockery reveals the irreverence, even absurdity, of the visitors' expectations of the place. They mock the typical consumer attitude towards foreign countries, which tourists naturally assume when traveling abroad. The attitude that other places exist for the sole purpose of satisfying the tourist's appetite for pleasure. The irony of the poem, however, serves to bracket off the projected ideas that the tourist brings with them. Although undeniably present, the cultural assumptions which the self brings to the other are critically examined and thereby kept at bay, because they're revealed as biased constructs, not a truthful representation of reality. So by questioning the assumptions that the tourists bring to the place, by ridiculing, albeit rather mildly, sort of the unreasonable expectations, the ethnocentric expectations that the tourists bring with them, Elizabeth Bishop is essentially telling us that, or rather the poetic persona is telling us that she's aware of the limitations of approaching another culture, of approaching another place. Unlike what the case is in Marlowe, Marlowe is not aware of his own limitations, or doesn't seem to be aware all the time. There is a kind of clash of criticism here. Now, I'll just briefly sum up the entire argument with the map, because I think it's significant in more than one ways, this particular poem. The map, as the title itself suggests, is another work where the representation of space features prominently. Through a series of rather playful, even whimsical similes and rhetorical questions, the poetic voice interrogates a cartographic image and, by extension, the cartographic convention as a whole and our understanding of it. The favored devices through which this is achieved are animation and anthropomorphism. In the first stanza, the land, shadowed green, appears intent to lean down to lift the sea from under and draw it around itself, which is something that only a human being can do. In the second stanza, the Canadian peninsula of Labrador, which extends into the Atlantic Ocean just above the United States, is assimilated to a dog breed, and a short narrative is attached to this image. We learn that it belongs to an Eskimo who has followed the local practice of oiling it, which apparently has produced its yellowish color on the map. Norway appears as an overexcited rabbit rushing southwards in the last stanza. Now, this use of animation and anthropomorphism serve to bring elements of sensation and motion into the representation of space that we know to be scientifically accurate, objective, and hence devoid of any subjectivity. The element of subjectivity is explicitly introduced in the second stanza, where the positioning of the town names is attributed to the emotions of the printer. The names of seashore towns run out to sea, the names of cities cross the neighboring mountains. The printer here experiencing the same excitement as when emotion too far exceeds its cause. And it is further emphasized towards the end of the poem, firstly by the question, are they assigned? Or this subjectivity is further emphasized towards the end of the poem, firstly by the question, are they assigned or can the country pick their colors? And then by the intimation that mapmakers' colors conceal some subtle mystery. Now, all these playful images and puns must seem a bit childish and immature, but they have very serious ramifications for our understanding of representations of space. The constant questioning of the cartographer's conventions in the text, the meaning of the colors of the physical landscape or the countries, the shapes and spatial orientation of the images represented, the positioning of name on the map surface, reveal the map as essentially a human construct rather than fact. Being a human construct, the cartographic representation is revealed as potentially biased and fallible, because all the elements included on the map are the result of a selection process motivated by a particular human agenda. Now, I would like to draw a parallel with realism here, right? You remember in the 19th century, realists claimed that their representation of reality was truthful because it employed the scientific method of observation and description in its representation of the world. Works such as The Map render this claim void, because they demonstrate that even the scientific representation of the world, of space and place, are not entirely devoid of subjectivity. No matter how hard it strives after objectivity, every human representation of the world follows a particular convention, which is intrinsically imbued with certain values, ideas, that predetermine the choices made in the act of representation. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, so we can't talk about Ngugi wa Thiong'o, but this is something that you might want to consider when you go back home or during your seminar discussions. Essentially, how the space in the novel reflects the collectivist agenda of decolonization and of building a new nation. There's a very useful book that you might come across in the library called Imagine Communities by Benedict Anderson. In this particular book, he talks about how nations are imagined and recreated within space. But mind you, the space that Benedict Anderson is talking about is homogeneous. It's uniform. This is the space of the realist novel, not the space of the modernist novel. And the reason is very clear. Realism is about the collective, whereas modernism is about the individual. And decolonization and nation building are processes that involve collectives, not just individuals. Thank you.